good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is April 20th. It's Tuesday, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, good afternoon, Melody.
Beautiful day here on the Eastern Shore. Spring fever has occurred here in the office of Discount Gold and Silver. But we're here, and we're ready to go. Gold was ready to go. Didn't show any spring fever today, up 6:30, 1778. Silver did, though, was down 2 pennies at 25.89. Platinum was down 20 bucks at 1,193. Palladium was down 48 at 2,820. And USDX today is up a whole 0.09 and 91.19, although it's still, you know, the dollar, I mean, it was ready to break through into 89, so holding here at 91 is a considerable feat. Crude oil is down 77 at 62.61. Let's go to the paper markets, the U.S. market. The Dow closed about 250 points lower. Now, we've had some back-to-back losses, but, hey, it's still at 33,820, down 256. The S&P, down 28 to 4,134. NASDAQ was down 128 to 13,786. And let's see. I'm using a new site here, so I'm just getting used to it. The bonds today, 10-year yield was down 0.35 at 1.56. It's a big drop. And Asian markets were mixed, but the Nikkei was lower by almost 2%. And Europe, you have the DAX, that was down about 1.5%. FTSE was down 2%, and so Europe did not fare well. Most of them were all down 2%, so we followed. Not quite as bad, but we followed. So we'll see what happens tomorrow, but we're still on course with, you know, the same old song and, I'm not going to say it's song and dance, but it's truth. The debt's too great to be paid. So this is what we talk about, and I will probably talk a little bit about it again in today's program. But first, Dave, I think you wanted to talk a little bit. We didn't mention it once, but Russia's been holding last-minute military exercises near commercial shipping lanes in the Black Sea. Again, that's threatened to strangle Ukraine's economy. We've been talking about the buildup of the military on the border. Of course, we've seen that happen with leaked memos from Russian forces escalating their presence on all sides of the Ukrainian border. We had last Friday, Russia announced it intends to block foreign ships in parts of the Black Sea for military exercises through October, an escalation that a State Department spokesperson condemned as an example of Moscow's ongoing campaign to undermine and destabilize Ukraine. Again, this just continues. The Pentagon, they called off plans to send 2 U.S. warships to the Black Sea. No explanation was given. The leaked Ukrainian document assesses that the total area of Russian military exercises take up 27% of the Black Sea.
That's a lot.
It seems like a lot, and a proportion that has steadily crept up in a sign of efforts to establish de facto control over these international waters. You have the Russians are also leveraging civilian infrastructure for military purposes. Now, this is a leaked document. I guess you can, do you believe leaked documents? But, Dave?
Sure, why not?
Why not?
I mean, you know, it depends. But, I mean, all the I mean, certainly the telltale signs are there.
True.
No. But, you know, proof is in the satellite photo, as they say in the intelligence community these days.
I thought it was in the pudding.
Well, You know, we live in different times, don't we?
I guess.
I love the Leave It to Beaver age of simplicity, but lasts no longer. Excuse me there. U.S. official said that the weaponization of energy infrastructure in the Black Sea should be a warning sign of what's to come if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which would bypass Ukraine and deliver Russian gas directly to Europe, comes to fruition. Biden has said he opposes Nord Stream 2, although it said he's unlikely to sanction European allies like Germany to stop its last stretch of construction. Now, much of the concern over Russia's aggression in recent weeks, as we've talked about, has been directed not at its activities in the Black Sea, but as Melody mentioned, at its border with eastern Ukraine. That's where the EU's top diplomat claims more than 150,000 troops have now amassed. And the leaked document shows that Russian forces are escalating their presence on all sides of the Ukrainian border with units that have a vast array of capabilities, including some that suggest more sinister intentions than a simple show of force. Got to believe that that's missiles that are probably already raised in the air in ready position. Now, it could be that the document is designed to distract from domestic problems, Russia's domestic problems, ahead of legislative elections in September, or to counter NATO exercise and simply bully Ukraine into reversing the positive political developments there. But it also finds a high probability that Russia may be seeking to provoke Ukrainian forces just to create the pretext for a military incursion, just like it did 13 years ago in Georgia. That is, the nation, the former Georgian Republic of the Soviet Union, Melody.
Well, you know, this morning I was trying to find it, but I just can't locate it. I'm a fan of Pat Buchanan. I mean, he just makes you think, and he always makes so much sense. And, you know, maybe we can try to put it in this week's newsletter, next week's newsletter. Fortunately, I can't pull it up here real quick. But, you know, he talks about this and all the wars that are surrounding us. And it's like, you know, when do we start saying no? The world is a different place today than it was. And that's what he talks about. What are our obligations? You know, it really is true. You know, and countries aren't the same. Countries, you know, they need to learn to start protecting themselves. They're in positions now. They're more powerful. They have more, well, I don't know if they have more money. They have more debt. They can create more money and so forth in order to begin protecting themselves. And what are our obligations anymore? They are different than what they were so many years ago. And so it was a very insightful article that he did, and we'll try to get that written up or put in a newsletter for next week. Federal Chair Jerome Powell, he wrote in an April 8th letter that the U.S. is going to temporarily see a little higher inflation this year as the economy strengthens. And I guess the biggest thing, Dave, is, you know, where he goes to work at, now they're beginning to see homeless encampments just blocks away from the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, so, how about it?
You know, it's like, you know, they're just so out of tune with what's really going on in this world, because their monetary policy isn't for the people of this country. It truly is for the banking system, the governments, and multinational corporations. So I don't, you know, we're just here, and I'm sure he's blind. They probably take him a different route so he doesn't have to see it. Who knows? I'm not condemning the man, but anyway, so we might see a little higher inflation this year. And of course, he had to say that the Fed is committed to keeping any overshoot within the limits. You know, well, what are their limits? You know, inflation is certainly higher than 2%, so I guess it'll keep it within our 10% limit. Who knows? In a letter to the Florida Senator Rick Scott, Powell said, "We do not seek inflation that substantially exceeds 2%, nor do we seek inflation above 2% for a prolonged period." Of course, there he didn't say how far above 2% for a prolonged period. You know, he says, "I would emphasize, though, that we are fully committed to both legs of our dual mandate, maximum employment and stable prices." And, you know, Dave, I was talking to someone last night. I mean, people aren't, jobs are there. People aren't going to work. They're available, but they truly are getting more off, particularly in your resort towns, your restaurants, your hotels, those, the service industry like that. And I had a conversation with some of the human resource at the casino here in this area. And they can't keep people. They can't even get them back. Because they say, why should I come back? I'm making more money off. And then what they do is, she says, well, they also call in. Because they're not allowed to come in if they have a headache. They're not allowed to come in if they have a cough. They're not allowed to come in. So they call off. Then they're given a week to recuperate from whatever they think is ailing them. And they get paid the whole. I mean, it really is. Why would anybody go to work? Why would anybody go to work? And we're going to talk about that later on, too, when we talk about assistance, UBI in California. But so we know that the Florida Senator Rick Scott is a vocal critic of Powell. He has warned that the Fed's low interest rates and bond buying program will force prices higher, of course, hurting the families and businesses. His office said in response to Powell's letter that the data is clear that inflation is rising, and Powell continues to ignore this growing problem, Dave.
Yeah, an email, a separate email, I believe, to some media outlet said that Senator Scott remains concerned about the impact inflation will have on low and fixed income American families. He is calling on Powell to wake up to this threat, lay out a clear plan to addressing rising inflation and protect American families. In his letter, Powell to Scott, Powell said that low inflation constrains, that's a good Powell word, the Fed's ability to offset economic shocks with easy policy, and that after a decade of too low inflation, the Fed is now aiming for inflation moderately above 2%. The letter added, "We understand well the lessons of the high inflation experience in the 1960s and 70s and the burdens that experience created for all Americans. We do not anticipate inflation pressures of that type, but we do have the tools to address such pressures if they do arise."
And just what are those pressures, Dave? What are the tools, I should say? What are the tools?
I guess that remains to be seen. It sounds like a credibility crisis, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, what are the tools to address such pressures if they do arise? Well, don't you address inflation with higher rates?
We will raise rates, tighten credit, make it more difficult for Americans, particularly middle and lower income Americans, to buy a home, businesses to get loans to expand, and on and on and on. And so the cycle goes.
Doesn't sound like that would be too good for the economy.
Not too much fun to be a Fed governor these days.
And again, Greenspan, it isn't. Doesn't matter. It's not so much what we do, it's what we say.
That's oh, it. Alan.
You know? So when you hear these articles and you hear the Powell and even the Treasury Secretary Yellen anymore, because she was once the Fed chair, you know, that's, or even all government officials, it's what they say. So pay attention. And this can't be too good either. The bond market. $59 billion flowing into the bond market so far this year, compared to $240 billion flowing into equities.
Well,
kind of tough to do a infrastructure when you don't have any money flowing into the bond market, I would think, Dave. Investors, advisors, they really don't want to own bonds at all, if they can help it. Now, this is, of course, he's the Dave Natick. He's the chief investment officer at ETF Trends. Treasury yields climbed earlier this year, but largely stabilized in recent weeks. And again, Powell said it's highly unlikely that they will raise rates this year. Kind of contradicts what he said about inflation if it gets out of hand. But if you look at what people are doing in their equity portfolios, it looks like rotation we would normally expect in a risk-off trade. It's just missing that core treasury allocation and so forth and so on. So, but that really is interesting. Only $59 billion we need people to buy into the bond market.
Yep, indeed. I'm not going to finish that article. I'm not sure it has anything that listeners don't already know. The only thing I can say about it is that we have a better idea, ladies and gentlemen. Do what others have been doing the past few weeks, and over time for sure, that is dropping their stocks and buying gold and silver coins. We've been doing it for 25 years. Let us help you and your family build financial security. Call us at 800-375-4188.
I'm not sure exactly. I don't believe the wealthy are panicking over Biden's tax proposals. I mean, we've heard throughout the years, usually most of the wealthy people say, go ahead. Yeah, you should raise taxes on us, because they know with their wealth they can easily find some way, somehow, to offset any increases, you know, offshore or, you know, some little loophole. They have the attorneys, they have the accountants, and very rarely do they ever feel the pinch of tax increases, Dave. That's what I believe. And, you know, you're real wealthy. You know, maybe you're middle wealthy or you're lower end wealthy. You know, that might have a little more impact them on whatnot. But as part of, are we heading into a break already?
I'm afraid we are.
No. Say it isn't so.
It be so.
We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TeamUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com. Sign up for a weekly newsletter. Heading into the break, we were talking about the wealthy panicking. And I think we discussed this during the break, and I think the wealthy ones are the ones that are around the 3.5 million, as we see the Biden administration trying to undo Trump's tax cuts that would bring the individual exemption down to 5.49 million. If Biden succeeds to restore taxation to 2009 levels, wealthy families would be subject to estate taxes after the first 3.5 million. So, you know, at that level, people do lose their properties. The result is a mad dash. You see these wealthy families trying to pass on their millions before they can no longer do so tax-free. And these advisors, tax attorneys, wealth advisors, they're busier than ever. The greatest way to pass your wealth, to redistribute your wealth, is through gold. That's the easiest way, the most legitimate way, the most legal way to distribute your wealth. But hey, there's a reason there's still loopholes in those little guidelines. And it's interesting to see that people are adjusting because I think they know it's coming, Dave.
Well, it's interesting. It's not just these estate taxes that are being looked at. It's a way to pay for the ambitious infrastructure agenda. Senate Democrats are looking to jack up capital gains taxes that wealthy people own on some of the stuff they inherit. Right now, they only pay taxes when they sell the assets and only on the increase in value since the last owner died. The stepped-up basis, as it's called. Biden's Treasury Department could also revive several other efforts to prevent the ultra-wealthy from playing fast and loose with the rules for assigning values to their assets. Eventually, the administration wants to raise all sorts of taxes on the rich, income, long-term capital gains, for example, to finance paid family and medical leave. As part of the caring infrastructure in the same pandemic that cost millions of ordinary people their lives, health savings, ability, or jobs, caused the fortunes of the country's wealthiest families and its largest corporations to grow and grow big. 2020 was likewise a pretty good year to make an estate plan. The technical reasons for this are tedious. But then again, what tax-related thing isn't? Children with gigantic intra-family loans, that's a way to avoid gift taxes, could refinance at favorable rates with the bank of mom and dad. There was an explosion, several estate planners said, in high-net-worth individuals laundering their brokerage accounts through a kind of trust that captures all the appreciation money minus interest, and then passes it on to their heirs, gift tax-free. Boy, Melody, it is sure good to live in the land of by and for the ultra-rich.
Yeah,
just my opinion.
But if you want to, if they want to change things, they don't need to do it by increasing. And I mean, I don't understand why they want to increase the taxes on the wealthy to pay for to finance paid family and medical leave. Why would you increase taxes on people to finance? It's not their job to finance paid family and medical leave. That's not, I mean, if a corporation wants to provide family and medical leave, then it's up to that multinational corporation or any business to provide it. It shouldn't be taxing the rich to pay for it.
Well, that's one side of it. The other side is that of the highly industrialized nations of the world, we're the only ones without a national paid family and medical leave policy. And I think that's the other side of it. Sure it does.
No, it doesn't, because again, you don't tax the rich to pay for a corporation's responsibility to provide family and medical leave. I mean, and a lot of these.
What if you're the tens of millions, one of the tens of millions of people who work part time, who don't get any benefits, who work less than 30 hours a week and therefore don't qualify for mandatory health benefits?
Well, you know what?
A lot of those paid time off or what have you.
A lot of those people that are now working 30 hours, they were robbed of hours when the Obamacare came into effect, and several times they had the lower corporations would lower the number of hours so that a lot of them wouldn't be approved.
So they wouldn't have to pay.
So that's right. But it's not the taxing of the rich to correct that. So let's look at the job problem. Let's get the poor people, let's get them back to work. Why can't they work? Why can't you bring back the jobs? But taxing the rich is not going to do it. It's just going to make it worse. And again, the wealthy, we'll just pull their money and go someplace else.
Bye-bye.
So then how do you get family and medical leave for the people that are so...
Well, first of all, the rich aren't going to flee. They're fleeing from one state to another, perhaps. Certainly the 0.1% undoubtedly have properties in other countries that may have more favorable taxes, but they're still citizens of the U.S. They still pay U.S. Income taxes, and I think they're here for more than one reason, and I guess I don't see that happening in mass. It's not like we're they're looking to tax 100, even 50% of their marginal income. So,
but taxing isn't the solution to the problems.
Well, you want to pay for it. How do you pay for things if it's,
we shouldn't be paying for half of the things that we are. Let's cut some things. How about that? Wow. Let's cut someplace else.
Let's look at the $800 billion Pentagon budget. I'm sure we could find a couple hundred billion there. Help pay for something like that.
How about the trillions of dollars to the COVID relief plans? When does it all end? When does it stop?
It ends when there's an implosion or a reset.
Yeah. That's when it's going to end. Why tax? It's going to end sooner or later. So let it end so we can move on. And I don't know the answers because we don't have all the facts, but I'll tell you what, it's all they're doing, just like they've always done, is just both administrations, both sides of the aisle. They don't fix anything. They just create more problems. And you're right. It's going to stop at a reset. And, you know, we're going to talk about manufacturing. You know, the Build Back Better initiative argue, the proponents of that argue that if the focus was to be retrained on manufacturing, the sector could provide improved and sustainable economic growth. Well, that's just great. They talk about it, but they don't do anything about it. You know, the infrastructure and manufacturing investments are top priorities for this plan. But if we look at history, it's really not on Biden's side, and Congress is already asking for plenty of compromises. The PPE crisis and recent chip supply shortages have highlighted the negative economic cost of globalizations. Well, yeah. And the U.S. dependence on foreign nations to provide a multitude of necessary goods and supplies. There was a new report from McKinsey Global Institute suggests that the pandemic can serve as a key moment to revitalize growth and competitiveness in 16 process sectors of manufacturing. We already know it's not going to happen. We already know there isn't anything that can bring anything. Manufacturing isn't going to come back by any important means. It's going to hear about the same thing we've learned in the last administration. You know, but all this is supposed to help the U.S. grow annual GDP by more than 15%. I mean, these numbers are just, I mean, 15%
above.
But they're still dreams.
Forecasts.
15% above baseline forecasts.
15% above 10%. Yeah. Wow.
And 1.1 million jobs by 2030? That's not a lot of jobs. Especially when you're having the technology with robots. You know, I mean, 1.1 million jobs is not a lot.
Isn't that what we used to see a year, every year, close to it?
Yeah. But the 16 recommended focus sectors are semiconductors, medical devices, communications, electronics. So, but then
yeah.
Again, I mean, you're seeing, you know, 6 to 11% global GDP growth annually. But.
Yeah, you know, it's and manufacturing will always be an emotionally laden discussion in America. Just because we came from a place where we were by far the largest manufacturer of, you know, you name it. So whether you, whatever, if you're into the blame game, there's plenty of it to go around, and we won't go there at this point. That's an interesting topic for a future program. But I mean, look, all levels of government in the U.S. have spent more than $85 billion on 15,000 initiatives over 10 years. This is probably according to McKinsey report, while General Motors alone spends $80 billion a year across 15,000 global suppliers. But while edicts like Buy American, Biden's executive order, may demonstrate the president's penchant for investment, critics say, you know, such laws and orders raise costs and lower quality and are too easily circumvented by savvy multinational corporations. They've been doing it for decades. To wit, Adam Posen, who's head of the Peterson Institute, says the U.S. needs to stop fixating on manufacturing jobs as a driver for growth and should focus more on universal benefits and embrace international expansion and competition.
Isn't that great?
That's another one for debate. Posen argues a politician's sentimental obsession with manufacturing enables manufacturing companies to feel they are too big to fail, potentially leading to production monopolies that drive up consumer prices and drive down wages. I've got to get a copy of that. I want to know how many manufacturing companies in the U.S. Feel like they're too big to fail. Let's look at their profit and loss statements, and let's compare them to J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo and Citibank, and then you tell me. I'm sure that there are companies with solid balance sheets, but boy, to use that as a reason, essentially, for essentially giving up on manufacturing, I just think spells a lot of trouble for us down the road. Even if you argue it's not coming back, it more and more could go away. I mean, as China becomes a little bit, not a little bit, as they gradually become larger and more powerful, and with all the things going on with currencies and digital currencies, and God knows, you know, with uncertain impacts on future commerce, and with the robotization of the workforce in general, I think there's a lot of good reason for us to be focused on. I mean, look at the international chip shortage, Melody. Think if we could corner a piece of the market on that, how much it would be to our benefit. In any event,
that's all fine and dandy. And you know what? Yeah, we should. But the fact of the matter is, we can't and we won't because we can't compete. It's that simple. And it is an emotional debate because, you know, that's why you have to tax the rich more to pay for the people who can't work or don't have jobs that provide benefits and so forth. I mean, those manufacturing jobs used to do that. And I get that we're in a new world, you know, and so again, we're back to the answers. I'm not quite sure what focus on more universal benefits consists of.
Well, look at this. How about, here's a fairly radical idea, I'm sure. Maybe I won't be invited back to the program after this. Hold your breath. No, it's not that bad. What happens if there's like a 1 or 2 year moratorium on stock buybacks, on dividends, on bonuses to executives, and all the profits, all the profits, or a good portion of the profits of multinationals are required to go toward hiring new jobs. Think of how that would, the multiplier effect of that in just 3, 4, 5 years, that would have the impact on that company and on the economy as a whole.
Yeah, but you have to have whatever promotes their, you have to have the demand. You just can't. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. You know, we talk about all these different aspects of, you know, taxing and manufacturing and these and from both sides of the aisle and so forth. But to me, let me bring it back to where we're at. We have, I mean, there are problems. And these problems, as far as I'm concerned, are driven by our monetary system, our debt, and the inflation that we have experienced over the years. So it is, I can't think of anything that can truly be fixed until that system gets fixed. And the only thing they're going to do is they're going to continue the infrastructure. All of this talk is all about, you know, programs, creating programs. Even Powell said that he's got tools if inflation gets out of hand. And they're just going to continue to throw everything at it until they just can't anymore, until it comes to an end. Because we have too many problems to be, Dave, I think we have too many problems in order to be successful in anything that they try to create. I mean, that's just the way I look at it. I mean, you know.
Are you suggesting we do nothing then?
No, they're doing it. They're printing money and creating all this stuff just to keep it going. But eventually it's not fixing the problems. Problems have to be fixed. I guess maybe if you're in a, I was going to relate it to a bad marriage, but I don't know about that. Problems have to be fixed. And you just can't print yourself out of the problems. And that's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because their solutions aren't good solutions. They're not healthy solutions. And they're not going to create the thing that we need here in this nation to make people get out of poverty. And that's jobs. You know, I started the program by talking about, hey, people don't want to work. There's a battle to get employees down here where I live. And it's actually raising the wages. I mean, it is raising wages, and they still don't want to work. So, and the businesses here, either they're going to have to step up to the pump and pay the increased wages, but we're not sure where those wages are going to stop. But anyway, debt will never be paid. Higher a new debt is going to replace the expiring old debt. It's likely at some point that new debt will be issued to pay the interest on the existing debt and to finance increased government spending, thus ensuring that the total debt pile continues to grow exponentially. We're barely servicing the debt as it is. I'm not even sure if we are. I don't think we are. Now, this was an article in investing.com, and it points out that a superficial level, it seems as if government debt is neither a cost that will be borne by the current generation of taxpayers nor a cost that would be borne by future generations. After all, how could a debt that no one will ever have to repay be a genuine financial burden?
Mm.
Who writes these articles?
Mm.
Are they going to be surprised? the mistake that most people make is to assume that the main cost of government debt is association with the obligation to repay. Well, it is, though. This assumption leads to the conclusion that if all for practical purposes, there will never be a requirement to pay down, much less pay off the debt, then the debt effectively is costless, and there really is such a thing as a free lunch. Right, Dave? Wrong. There is no free lunch, ladies and gentlemen. In a technical sense, if government debt is purchased by the private sector, then the main cost is actually immediate and is due to the transfer of a private sector investment to government spending. For example, money that would have been invested in building businesses that add to the wealth of the economy is diverted to government programs.
Well, I guess then what they're saying is adding to the government's debt converts one form of spending, the bulk of which would have been productive in a relatively, quote, free economy, to a different form of spending, the bulk of which will be unproductive. But what if government debt were purchased by the Fed using money created out of nothing? Aha. The aha moment. Well, according to modern monetary theory, such debt would be costless. Here it is. As long as there was a sufficient slack in the economy as determined by inflation. In this case, the cost of the debt is not immediate. In fact, an increase in government spending is financed via the creation of new money. The short and intermediate term effects usually will be positive. Only become apparent years later in the form of busted bubbles, major recessions, and slower long-term economic progress. Most important costs of such policies stem from the falsification of prices caused by the injection of the new money. I can buy into that melody. Many of the investments that are made in response to these misleading price signals turn out to be bad or unproductive and end up being liquidated. So, I think essentially what this article is suggesting is that modern monetary theory is like a self-fulfilling prophecy, that sort of an extension of the all I want is everything, and when do I want it now, sort of mentality. That is, without the ability to see beyond the length of my nose as an elected decision maker, elected official decision maker, how in God's name am I to consider or even care about the long-term impacts of the decisions I'm making today? And, we underlying melodies of my discussions today have been a lot of, theory that we don't talk about in those terms. And they're they're what make up the fundamentals, which is obviously the most important. But unfortunately, we live in such a political system today, and essentially so much of our policy is driven by law and public regulations, that they become as important, if not more so, than the underlying principles. And perhaps that's what's leading to this, we can do anything because it doesn't matter. We can run up the debt another $10 trillion in 2 or 3 years or one, because it's not going to matter now. There's hardly any inflation and interest rates are zero. But you know what? Eventually, even if interest rates stay where they are now, you double or triple our debt, you're going to double or triple the interest on the debt. And while we're paying interest on our treasuries now, there's going to come a time when we might not be able to. And that's when the big D occurs. And the big D, default, leads to the big R, reset. And who among us wants to be around, much less, you know, have this fall on our children or grandchildren? We don't get our act together soon. It may not happen. We may not be around to see it, Melody, but by God, our children or theirs certainly will be. And what will they think of us then?
Well, I think we will be around. And I think we're going to see it. And the children and the grandchildren are still going to suffer. And it's, I guess it's kind of in the way that we just, that the system reminds me of, we just live for today. We're going to do whatever it takes today to get through the day. No one really cares about the future. No one really cares. And when you get into our political system anymore, it was always about the people, about the people, about the people, and it had never had anything to do for the people. And it is just, you know, and I get that countries evolve. I get that things, you know, I get all that. But we have given up a big part of our country. And it's, you know, the day of reckoning will come for the mismanagement, for the abuse, for the corruption. Just like every nation, we're no different. And, so the day is coming. Like Dave said, you know, we will have a default. We have debt too great to be paid. And it's just a matter of when. And just like Greg Hunter said yesterday, fraud ends very quickly. I've said for years, we'll wake up one day to a whole different world. And we kind of experienced a little of that last year. We'll multiply that by 100. And that's what we can wake up to. So anyway, if you're prepared and you got all your bases covered, you should be fine. But that's what we talk about when we say, you know, just take a look at what you have. And I get it. It's exciting to see all these record markets and many of retirements are living on their dividends and living. I get that. Now, I get you don't want, you know, you're waiting for it. You're waiting to see the crack. You know, we forget. We have short memories of what it was like last March. It's a year ago. It was last March when we began to see the markets drop 3,000, 2,000, 1,000 every other day. That's pretty scary times for a lot of folks who had their money invested. And, yeah, thank goodness that they were able to plug it and turn it around. But what created that is still there, just like it was in 2008, just like it was at the dot-com bust, just like it was in 87. So anyway, I don't mean to be lecturing or anything, but the whole thing is take a look around and be prepared.
Maybe we need to be lectured, Melody.
Really? You're the first one who's ever said that.
Keep on keeping on, girl.
But anyway, former J.P. Morgan Chase trader suing a bank, Donald Turnbull, a former global head of precious metals trading at J.P. Morgan Chase, has filed a doozy of a federal lawsuit against the bank. Turnbull worked on the same J.P. Morgan Chase precious metals desk that was deemed to be racketeering enterprise by the Justice Department when it handed down indictments back in 2019. Now, this is the first time that Wall Street observers could recall employees of a major Wall Street bank being charged under the Racketeer, Influenced, and Corrupt Organization Act, or RICO statute. And that's usually reserved for what? Organized crime? J.P. Morgan Chase, the largest bank in the U.S., has further unprecedented distinction for a U.S. bank of being charged with 5 felony counts by the Justice Department in just a 6-year span of time. The bank admitted to all the charges while its board kept chair and CEO Jamie Dimon at the helm throughout the unprecedented crime wave. giving the impression that crime is an accepted business model at the bank. But anyway, back to Turnbull's lawsuit that was filed earlier this month in the Federal District Court for the Southern District of New York. It alleges that the bank trumped up false charges against Turnbull as a pretext to terminate him when he was actually terminating him for cooperating with the Department of Justice investigation. So Turnbull was not one of the traitors indicted. Nevertheless, Turnbull states in the lawsuit that the indicted traitors received better benefits when they were released from employment than he did. So,
yeah, despite a seriously ill wife, Melody, Turnbull states in a lawsuit that JPMorgan Chase canceled his health insurance, did not pay him severance, and took away his unvested stock awards. Poor guy. The lawsuit offers multiple examples of how indicted traitors were treated in a far more favorable manner than Turnbull was. It's not the first time that JPMorgan Chase employees alleged that they were fired, then framed for wrongdoing. In 2013, Johnny Burris in Phoenix went through a similar situation. We won't go into that. Of course, JPMorgan denied then and will deny now. The fact of the matter is, five felonies, Melody. Unindicted workers get left hanging in the lurches. JPMorgan's Chase board has made their chair and CEO a billionaire while also richly rewarding themselves. Something is rotten in Denmark.
Yes, and we're out of time. So we'll be back tomorrow. Please stay and join us tomorrow. Don't stay. Go home. And listen to us tomorrow. So until then, be safe. Good night and God bless.
Bye-bye.
Have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man.